That's actually more frightening, I think. That's more terrifying than if I were in that room, as he hears the sounds of the whip and the scream and everything else. And that kind of sensibility, I think, extends throughout, doesn't it? There are a lot of scenes where most directors nowadays just immediately hit that button and give you horrific violence right in your face. But here, one reason why he holds back on it is that the character of Elwood in particular is very reflective, very quiet, contemplative. He takes in the world, what he sees and hears of it. And I think we're meant to share that sense with him, and that so much of what's going on around him is just outside of his frame. It's in that next room, or it's what he glimpses through a window. And I think that works incredibly well in the film.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about The Nickel Boys and about The Room Next Door, starting with The Nickel Boys. I read the book first. Did you read the book, Mike?
I have read the book. And in fact, we should talk literature for a little bit. We'll turn this into a literary half hour because this film, as we speak, it's been nominated for Academy Awards for Best Picture and also for Best Adapted Screenplay. So let's talk about the writing in that respect. It's based on a novel by Colson Whitehead. I've met Colson Whitehead in Baltimore because he's come here a few times to the Pratt Library. And I've read most of his books, including the one that is the source for this film. The novel is called The Nickel Boys. The film itself truncates it just to Nickel Boys. There are some other changes, more significant ones between the book and the film, but I don't want to get bogged down with that, you know, literary adaptation by way of changes made. But what I find so impressive, and I want to do some promotional work at the moment here. If you're a reader, you really got to be familiar with Colson Whitehead. I mean, he's a very impressive writer. So yes, to your immediate question, you know, I'd read the novel, The Nickel Boys. And one of the most amazing things about him as a writer, and he's really on a roll now, is that this book that we're talking about was published in 2019 and won the Pulitzer Prize. It's his second Pulitzer. He previously had won the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction for The Underground Railroad in 2016, which is another really impressive book. And what I love about Underground Railroad, the other book, is that he takes that notion of the Underground Railroad and he literalizes it. And it was amazing that nobody had ever thought to do this before. What if it were an actual railroad? You know, you're a runaway slave and you're heading north and you actually get on an Underground Railroad with stations along the way. It's a wonderful idea, isn't it? And it really plays out beautifully in the book. But in terms of winning two Pulitzer Prizes, it's not unprecedented, but he's only the fourth fiction writer to win the Pulitzer Prize twice. And the others, the company he keeps going way back in the 20th century, Booth Tarkington, but in the mid to late 20th century, William Faulkner and John Updike. Not bad company for a writer to keep. So you know, he's a great guy. He's a great writer. This is a case where we're talking about the film, but please read the book. Please. And now we have got to be careful in talking about either the book or the film not to have any spoilers, because there actually is a huge spoiler involved here. And I don't want to even get near it, but we will at least talk about the premise. So can I segue now to the film? All right.
Yes, let's talk about the film.
All right, I shall. I knew I would eventually. The basic notion is Colson Whitehead had read about the Arthur G. Dozy School for Boys in Florida, which was to use the euphemism, a reform school. Let's call it prison or torture chamber even. Horrible things happened there. And one of the most horrible aspects of that school, real life school, was that it lasted from 1900 to 2011. So even after the worst abuses were exposed, you know, that the place was still open. So that was really what prompted him to write the novel. And then I'll hand it off to you in a second here, but just to sort of set the stage briefly for that, there are two principal characters here who will be, I'll call them residents of the reform school. And Elwood is really the one we'll probably talk about most in the sense that he's a good kid. You know, he's got aspirations for college or whatever and all, and just gets caught. He gets caught up in an unfortunate circumstance. Nothing really of his fault. He's really innocent, but he's pulled into this and very quickly sent off to this school, which amounts to a prison sentence. And there are many bracing aspects of not just the story, but how it's filmed. So let me hand off at this point, and then we can double back on some of those observations.
Well, the overall theme is how those who are supposed to protect us will often abuse that power and then crush anyone who points this out. So that's kind of where the narrative is kind of driving. But what makes it such a great movie to watch is all these interesting point of view shots. It's almost like the camera is inside the body of the person who is they're focusing on. It's also kind of elegant the way they go back and forth between the two characters of Elwood and Turner as characters. In particular, there's a scene in the lunchroom that you see from one character's perspective. And then later, when you see it again from the other character's perspective, you realize that what you thought you saw the first time wasn't even accurate. So it's such a cinematic way to approach it. There's also a really wonderful scene involving a hug between Turner and Elwood's grandmother. And the point of view of it is like you're the person actually getting the hug. It's really effective, Mike. I mean, what did you think of that technique?
That's the most striking aspect of the film on a technical level. The film's director, Ramel Ross, this is his first feature film. I mean, it's really striking that, you know, it's so accomplished that way. He co-wrote it with Jocelyn Barnes, so they're sharing in that Academy Award nomination for adapted screenplay. His previous film, which I've seen, was the 2018 documentary, Hale County, This Morning, This Evening, set in Alabama, focusing very much on a couple of rural characters. It's really a very distinctive documentary film in terms of technique, actually, in terms of how he shoots it. And of course, that sort of Deep South culture, if I can call it that, is something that both films have in common. I mean, you really get that, I don't want to say folkloric in a kind of overly sentimental way, but it really does take you into that culture, and you really feel like you're inhabiting it. He has it's a kind of tactile sensibility that if he takes you out into a field or somebody's kitchen or wherever, you feel like you're there. That it's grounded. Let's put it that way. And in terms of the technical aspects of shooting this film, one of the things that Ross insisted on was he wanted it to be a point of view sensibility here. How do the kids, particularly, you know, Turner and Elwood, see things? And so oftentimes those two actors, the Brandon Wilson and Ethan Harris, who play those characters, they oftentimes, you know, literally have the camera, a small camera strapped to them. So in many of the scenes, if it's a POV like that point of view, it's not only very much through the eyes of that character, but in a sense, almost through the body of that character as that person moves and all. One aspect of that, speaking of aspect ratios, one aspect of that would be the fact that oftentimes there's very tight cropping in the film. So it's not just a matter of like a lot of close-up or medium close-up shots, but sometimes like at the edge of the frame, most directors would show you a little bit more of something. So there are places in the story where you're not quite sure what happened or who's there or whatever. But that's also in the way we oftentimes have a more limited awareness or prescience than movies generally will acknowledge. But there's a second reason for it, namely that the book is quite graphic in places. I mean, it has to be really in terms of what's done to these boys by the administrators. And people have wondered, well, that visceral quality, that violence, you know, movies nowadays are not shy about showing that, but how to handle it here. This director, I think, very astutely decided not to go that obvious route of blood and guts and torture, right, you know, right in your face, front and center, partly because of that kind of partial framing. Sometimes there are things that occur just outside of the frame that, you know, but then he expands on that in the sense of there's a scene in particular where Elwood, periodically, any infraction, you could be sent off to a room and be, you know, whipped and whatever else. And there's a scene where he's sitting there and he's sort of waiting his turn. He's in the room and we can hear what's happening in the next room. So that's not a matter of the limited viewpoint of a camera strapped to you, because, you know, you could easily take your camera into that room too, couldn't you? But to keep the camera with Elwood and as he hears, that's actually more frightening, I think. That's more terrifying than if I were in that room, as he hears the sounds of the whip and the scream and everything else. And that kind of sensibility, I think, extends throughout, doesn't it? There are a lot of scenes where most directors nowadays just immediately hit that button and give you horrific violence right in your face. But here, one reason why he holds back on it is that the character of Elwood in particular is very reflective, very quiet, contemplative. He takes in the world, what he sees and hears of it. And I think we're meant to share that sense with him, and that so much of what's going on around him is just outside of his frame. It's in that next room, or it's what he glimpses through a window. And I think that works incredibly well in the film. I mean, it's a very powerful film.
It is a very powerful film, and I appreciate it not being confronted with a lot of graphic scenes, because let's face it, when someone says to you, hey, you want to go see this movie about reform school in Florida during the Jim Crow era? You think, oh yeah, that sounds like a good time. Not. I mean, it just doesn't sound like something the way you would entertain yourself on purpose. And also, what happens in your mind, just hearing what Elwood's hearing, I think is graphic enough to get the idea across.
Now, even though earlier I said I don't want to get too focused on, you know, from page to screen type issues, but there's something that should be mentioned, I think. And I don't think it really hurts the film so much as just to me indicates that the film is strong and the book is stronger yet. And here's the way in which I would phrase this. In the book, every time you go from one chapter to the next, and they are short chapters, you are going from one character to the next, one time period to another. So there are temporal and character jumps that way, but you have a bit of, let's call it preparation, because that's kind of editing too, isn't it? It kind of, you know, gives you a moment to pause and contemplate, and then you go on to whatever's next there. And there are surprises along the way, but you have that kind of pacing to it. In the film, there is a lot of jumping around from more or less present day footage to much earlier, back and forth that way. There are moments in the film where I would not say it's confusing, but it sometimes can take you a few seconds to sort of get grounded in that sense. And I think it's frankly a little awkward or cumbersome at times. I don't think that's always handled quite as gracefully in the film or as clearly, as cogently as it might be. How do you feel about that? Because even though I like this film a whole lot, but I had that as, I'll call it a quasi-criticism or a concern. Did you share that whatsoever? There were places in the film where and I'd already read the book, and I was watching with an audience of people who mostly had not read it, and they were confused at times, and I was sort of filling things in for them. I said, you know, I've read the book, and I'm still slightly confused in this scene. And then it's like the light bulb goes on. Oh, yeah, right. That's what happens in this scene. Did you ever have moments like that?
I did. I did think that it was a little bit hard to follow, because certain things I expected, even though I'd read the book too, I sat there puzzling, like I didn't understand. After the scene where Turner meets Elwood's grandmother, he never does give him the package or even tell him that he met his grandmother. And it's that sort of, and yet they're supposed to be really good friends. I don't know. There was just some disjointed parts for me story-wise.
Yeah, I think there are. There's some narrative gaps that way. The book is going to fill in much more detail, or at least in a more readily comprehensible way. In the film, there's that bit of puzzlement. And again, I can't say much more without spoiling some of what happens towards the end of the film. But there are some crucial scenes near the end of the film where it just seems like either something dropped out, or it's assuming people have read the book just before seeing the film. And again, much as I admire this director for his first time film, after all, I think that's a place where maybe it does show a little bit. He's new to feature filmmaking. And I think for any director, if it were told in a straightforward chronological fashion, that would be different and much easier. But he's taken on a more complicated scenario or sense here of jumping around in time and characters back then, characters now today. And again, without spoiling anything, that is going to have like some big payoff as the story goes along. And I just think it's, you know, slightly awkward within the film. Don't let that deter you from seeing it. Just realize there might be moments where you're not entirely sure what you're watching. So there's a recommendation.
I think people are going to be talking about that scene with the hug for just in terms of analyzing movies. And I just want to call out that actress, Anjanou Harris-Taylor, is so good in this. And it's really kind of a small but crucial role. But in that scene, you know, when you're watching it, bear in mind that she's not acting across from a real actor. She's acting across from a camera right in her face. And the fact that she just comes across with such warmth and sincerity, it's just an absolutely perfect, fabulous scene.
Think about all the movies today where actors are not acting across from another actor. It's, you know, it's like green screen technology. Look scared because the monster's over there. So I appreciate a film like this where even if you're not looking at another person, at least you're looking at a camera, looking at something.
All right, Mike, what do you think the odds are that it will win Best Picture and or Best Adapted Screenplay?
I really hesitate to respond because I'll end up looking foolish. You know, we're having this conversation with the nominations out, but with the ceremony still a few weeks off. I did see the film at a preview screening some weeks ago, where we actually brought that up during the audience discussion as to whether this film would be nominated for much. Because in some of the other award ceremonies, earlier prizes, if you will, it was not totally overlooked, but wasn't one of the films that was getting all the big nominations. And actually, when it did get the Best Picture nomination here, I felt vindicated because I was predicting that. I was right on that. I want it known I was right about that it would be nominated. But some of the other audience members were a little doubtful. Not that they disliked the film. They just thought it's such a tough subject. And mm-hmm. the film itself is borderline confusing at times. And occasionally it has a, I don't want to call it a cool sensibility, but occasionally it has a sort of withdrawn quality. You know what I'm getting at? It's sort of meditative or pensive that way. And that doesn't always get you nominations. And so I'm happy it got those two. And then the categories where it's most deserved. I mean, as the for the overall picture. But I got to say, you know, even though I had some qualms about the adapted screenplay, it's a really challenging piece of work to take that novel and decide how to do that on screen. So I'm happy with that. Since you put me on the spot that I have to predict something, I don't think it'll win anything, but I think it's an honor that it got the nominations.
Okay, we'll go with that. So speaking of things that are difficult to talk about, let's move on to The Room Next Door. All right, how do we set this up, Mike, while giving away nothing?
I usually give away everything. Let me start off by just mentioning some safe biographical details. The director is the Spanish director, Pedro Almodovar. He's beloved by both of us. I use him in several of my courses, specifically his films, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, All About My Mother, and Volver. And those are all films, speaking of spoilers, those are all films, particularly like Volver, where there's some big reveals. But every time I watch it, I'm so pulled into it. It's like I'm surprised all over again. Oh, no. Like I've seen it dozens of times. But, oh, no, that's who she is. On a more somber note, and the film is on a somber note oftentimes, The Room Next Door, bear in mind that Almodovar is now 74 years old. His films are certainly no strangers to mortality, and yet, but oftentimes treated in a darkly humorous way in earlier films. But now that he's in his 70s and coming off of a feature film, Pain and Glory, his most overtly autobiographical film, he is thinking about and dealing very directly with issues of mortality. And this is a film in which two women who had been friends for a while, but then this, and I love this as a subject. A lot of movies are about friendship, of course, but a friendship in which you were friendly with somebody, but then there's been a long gap. And it's not necessarily because of some melodramatic meltdown, you had a big fight or whatever. It's not that. Life happens, as they say, right? So you were really friendly with somebody and some years have gone by and you reconnect. And of course, the film's all about the reasons for reconnecting and how their friendship resumes. But again, on that safe level of just simply getting us foregrounded with the subject and where Almodovar is in his career, this is his first English language feature film. I'll quickly point out that he has made two short films in English, both of which I've seen. One is the gay Western, A Strange Way of Life. And the second one, more directly relevant to our conversation and to this film, would be Tilda Swinton delivering a monologue in The Human Voice. And that's based on the Jean Cocteau piece. And the reason it's so directly relevant here, not just that it's in English, but the fact that the stars of this English language film are Tilda Swinton and Julianne Moore. And as I've said to you and to everyone I talked to when I mentioned this film, how can you go wrong? Pedro Almodovar, Tilda Swinton, Julianne Moore. What a lineup. I want to see that movie. So I think we can talk a little bit about the premise, certainly. I mean, Marie, why don't you take over at this point in terms of what brings the women together again?
Okay, and I will say that this director is the one who I immediately think of if you're going to make a movie about two women sitting around talking. I mean, that's kind of one of his stocks in trade. Both of these women are writers who worked at a magazine back in the day, and they reconnect because Julianne Moore's character runs into a mutual friend who says, oh, you know, did you know that Martha is sick? And so she looks her up, and the gist of reconnection leads to a point where Tilda Swinton's character, Martha, asks Julianne Moore's character, Ingrid, to basically assist in a suicide, that she doesn't want her to do anything. She just wants her to be in the next room, hence the title. Now, here's my main problem with this movie. And I really liked everything I went in thinking I was going to find, which would be, you know, this director, these two actresses, all of that stuff is top notch. What fell flat for me is, apparently they worked at some magazine together, and you get all these flashbacks that inform you about minor plot details, but they never show you them being friends at this magazine back in the day. And I felt like it was a big hole because I wanted to see where their friendship started from. We're just picking up later at a really crucial time. I just thought since they had all those flashbacks, they should have addressed that more directly. What did you think, Mike?
The flashbacks are intriguing and a bit frustrating. I agree with you that there's more I'd like to know about them. I'd want to have a better sense of what the friendship was like. And I think it hampers things. It hurts things a bit. It doesn't destabilize the film completely. But where it's a nagging doubt is that later on, once they've reconnected and once the agreement's been made that Ingrid, the Julianne Moore character, will stay with and watch over and assist with the suicide, presumably for Martha, the Tilda Swinton character. At that point where they've reconnected, these are two women who, you know, they're into middle age. They'd known each other, you know, 20 years ago, whatever, back in the day. And here they're reconnected. And they really are living together. And they're in this really difficult situation. I mean, you know, where, you know, the one character is dying and wants the other one to help her die. And what could be more poignant than that? And it is poignant. And yet when you realize that, you know, there is a tentative quality to it, in the sense that, particularly for the Julianne Moore character, like, well, I haven't seen you in so long. Like, why me? Why are you asking me? You know, and so Marie, you're absolutely on target with that, as in wondering, well, how close were they back in the day to now have this, you know, like, what could be a bigger imposition on somebody or a bigger ask than to do something like this? And I think it does nag at me as I'm watching it. What finally, not that I ever swatted it away and said, oh, well, don't worry about it. It's just that the flashbacks themselves tend to be, as I say, fragmentary, and they kind of come and go, and they're not fully satisfying there. But what ultimately is fully satisfying is what you and I said at the outset. When you have Almodóvar, who's like, you know, just about the greatest director of women these days, to have two women just sit and talk, and these two actresses playing those women, that's pure enjoyment just at the level of movie going, isn't it? So when the two of them are just looking at each other across the table and talking, I can almost forgive and forget everything else that I've just cited as a nagging worry. So the film does really satisfy on that level.
It also has some beautiful moments of cinematography. There's some seriously bright red lipstick going on and some really bright colors worn here and there, which is kind of wonderful because it's such a dark topic. Sort of brighten it up with these bright colors is, I think, a genius move.
When I was watching it with an audience, you know, people were commenting on how, if you have to die, what a great house to die in, right? And also the clothing, the costuming, the chunky outfits they're wearing, which, again, Almodóvar is terrific at production design and costuming and all that. And I laughed and pointed out that, you know, in terms of the room next door, well, the door is red. And I said, of course, it has to be red. It's an Almodóvar film. There's going to be red lipstick, as you mentioned, and a red door, right? So, and then this is where there is, in his career, all career long, a kind of overt theatricality oftentimes. These are movies that really want you to know they're movies as much as anything else. And they want to have it on both levels. And it works somehow, you know, that you get pulled into a story, but you realize there's a degree of artifice or overstatement, whatever. The early films he did could be so campy, so over the top and all. He's done more serious comedies and just dramas in recent years. And that also led to something that for some viewers has been a reservation. For me, it was like an observation more than a reservation. Namely that this film has, I won't call it a stilted quality, but it has a deliberate, overtly theatrical nature to a lot of the dialogue. It's the kind of dialogue where somebody will ask, well, why are you unhappy? And the other person will say, well, I am unhappy because, you know, it has that kind of a quality back, which works better on stage typically than in a film. But Almodóvar has been known to do that. So one of the jokes I've had with people I've talked to about the film is it's the kind of film where it does work as his first English language film, but it probably would work even better in Spanish with subtitles. what do you think about that?
I think that is actually genius. I think they should dub it and then force everybody to watch it with subtitles. I wanted to say one other thing about their friendship, the same thing that bothered me about the Nickel Boys, which was there's these things that they're keeping from each other. I mean, Julianne Moore's character completely does not tell Tilda Swinton's character that her ex-boyfriend that she stole or they swapped or whatever it was, is still very much in the picture, but she doesn't reveal that. I just thought that was one of those friends, not friends things.
Well, you know what, Marie, but that's one thing I actually liked about it, in the sense that even close friends will keep things from each other sometimes. In other words, like, even when you feel you have an open relationship, there's certain things that don't get mentioned that maybe should. So, and I think it's a really mature aspect in the scripting, that it would be all too easy to have him say, oh, but John Turturro plays that character. Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, I just saw him last week at the coffee shop, kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. And then they could talk about him that way. But the fact that sometimes people will hold back on things that you know, they probably shouldn't. And I like that, because it adds to the diciness of it. They're friends, but how close, and what do they share, and what don't they share? And the Julianne Moore character in particular is skittish that way. She's not quite sure what she's been pulled into, if she wants to be there, if she wants to help with all this. And I think that kind of a detail actually adds to the film, and that it's not like as smooth sailing as it might be in some other dramatic treatments. She's kind of like, should I tell her or not tell her about certain things?
So last semester, we had a film discussions about famous director's final films, and one of them was John Huston's The Dead. So Mike, I'm going to leave it to you to finish us off by talking about that reference in this film, because I thought it was kind of lovely to have that come back.
Well, there are, being Almodovar, he's going to have cinematic references within the story. And so, yeah, I also thought that was a wonderful grace note here. And the fact that even though it's really somber subject matter, the characters themselves say, you've got to, like, I don't want to be treacly and say, look on the bright side, but Ingrid at one point says, you cannot go around telling people there's no hope. There are a lot of ways to live inside a tragedy. And I think Almodovar has been doing that in a lot of his films. Moreover, in an interview, a statement that Almodovar made about this film, he said, optimism is the best way to resist. And that's why this film actually, which should be incredibly depressing, it should be such a downer, it's really not in a lot of ways. There are a lot of ways in which you can see the beauty of their friendship, as tentative as the friendship might seem. And goodness knows that the beauty of the house and of the door and of the clothing and all that, that's a reason to live right there. I want a red door.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode, but don't forget to check out our other episodes on atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.